The kings of Macedonia. Philip becomes Philip II and takes control of Macedonia. Now, hindsight makes Philip the obvious choice to succeed his brother, but we have to remember that he was just 22 or 23 and probably unproven. He had administered a region for his brother and as a result commanded some troops. Control of an organized force, however small, strengthened his hand in the aftermath of the death of the king and the costly rout of his army. While it is possible that Philip had taken an active part in some of Perdiccas's campaigns, there's no direct evidence of this, and we cannot assume that he was able to boast of any personal military achievements. Apart from his nephew, there were other Argives to consider, not the least his three half-brothers, the sons of Gygae. If these made a bid for power, it was quickly defeated. The eldest, Archelaus, was executed by Philip, most likely around this time, and the other two escaped into exile. More serious challenges came from outside the kingdom, so were not on the spot to challenge the decision of the assembly. Pausanias, the man defeated with the help of Hippocrates, reappeared, this time backed by the Thracian king Argeas, most likely the same man who had briefly supplanted Philip's father Amystasis, although renewed his claim to rule and was backed by Athens with ships, men, and money. Philip was chosen to lead Macedonia, presumably with the support of the majority of the influential men at court and by the acclamation of the assembly. Rarely did the Macedonians refer to their monarch as king, Belaeus. Instead, he would simply be Philip, son of Amystasis. Although we cannot be for sure of the status, the Macedonians knew who Philip was and what powers he held and what influence he wielded. In many ways, it does not matter whether he was a regent or king, for either way, it was up to him to deal with the usurpers and defend the kingdom. Bardylus of Illyria had overrun and occupied large parts of Upper Macedonia, and was well placed to raid further afield. The Paeonians, another neighboring tribal kingdom, also began sending plundering expeditions across the border. The bigger threats took a while to develop, since no one had expected Perdiccas to be killed or Macedonia to be plunged into the uncertainty inevitable at the start of a new reign. If the defeat had happened in late 360 BCE, then autumn and winter would soon follow, and warfare was rarely continued during these months, giving Philip a breathing space. Even if the king died in early 359 BCE, then there was still bound to be a lull before the storm. Both of the pretenders needed time to find allies, who then assisted them in raising armies. The Illyrians had won a great victory and no doubt wished to return home to celebrate and enjoy the spoils of success. This was simply one glorious episode in the long predatory conflict with Macedonia and other vulnerable regions. It was never a war to the death, but rather an ongoing source of profit. Bardylus took some territory, but could look forward to a renewal of payments of tribute from whoever succeeded Perdiccas, with the option of launching fresh attacks if the Macedonians failed to comply. Whatever the details of his status, Philip was now in charge of a kingdom that seemed on the verge of being torn apart by its neighbors. Philip had a short breathing space to consolidate his hold on power and prepare to meet the onslaught. That it would come from a disparate and mutually hostile array of opponents did not make it any less daunting. Nor was the condition of Macedonia encouraging after long decades of weakness. 4,000 soldiers who had died with Perdiccas represented at least a third of the royal army, and most likely included many of its best men. The survivors were understandably demoralized. While the quality of Macedonian soldiers was mixed even in more stable times, for well over a century, Macedonia had enjoyed a reputation for producing fine cavalry. These were drawn from those wealthy enough to afford a mount and body armor, men who had learned to ride at a young age. In contrast, Macedonian infantry was viewed with contempt as a poorly armed and unskilled rabble. Archelaus I, 413 to 399 BCE, had tried to address this weakness by issuing his soldiers standard equipment paid for by the state. But any improvements achieved by this do not seem to have outlived him. Philip's brother Alexander II made another attempt, organizing his infantry in a close order phalanx, like that used by the Greek hoplites, who had dominated the battlefield since the 5th century BCE. He also granted them an honorific title to foster their morale. He suffered too many defeats and was murdered too soon for there to be any lasting improvement. The weakness of Macedonia in this era cannot be overstressed. Alexander II had only minted coins in bronze, and Perdiccas III mainly in bronze, with some issues of silver coins conforming to Persian weights. This is in a marked contrast to the plentiful silver coinage minted by Bardellus the Illyrian and the rich gold, silver, and bronze issued from the cities of the Chalcidian League. The wider region was rich in natural resources. In the early 5th century BCE, Alexander I had controlled a silver mine that yielded one talent of precious metal a day, but now this lay in the territory no longer ruled by the kings of Macedonia. Iron and other minerals were still readily available, although it is clear that access to silver was greatly reduced. Gains made in recent years scarcely compensated for the scale of such losses. An exiled Athenian politician helped Perdiccas III to reform the sale of the franchises to collect harbor duties, doubling the income from 20 talents to 40 a year, a gain that was sufficiently large enough to be worth noting. Philip's brothers were not poverty-stricken, but they did bequeath a treasury far weaker than those of earlier monarchs. Yet Macedonia had the potential to be very wealthy. The climate, even in Lower Macedonia, is more continental than the Mediterranean, giving it a greater annual rainfall and less extreme heat in the summer. Olive trees, one of the central pillars of Greek agriculture, grew in only a few small areas within the kingdom, but most other crops, including cereals and vines, flourished, and there were extensive areas of good pasturage. In Upper Macedonia, the balance shifted in favor of animal husbandry rather than agriculture. But even there was plenty of fertile farmland. In all the regions, the population was reasonably large by ancient standards and able to feed itself from local produce. In southern Greece, decent arable land was in such short supply that woods had to long since be felled and even marginal ground was put under cultivation. In contrast, Macedonia had plenty of good farmland and extensive forests survived, with a useful mix of deciduous and evergreen trees. These provided fuel and building material for the population, but were a very valuable resource for export. Any major building project required long timbers for roof beams, and such things were simply not available locally in most of Greece. Timber was even more vital for shipbuilding, with keels, frames, masts, and oars all needing the right size and quality of wood. The forests also produced the pitch used to seal the hulls. The philosopher Theophrastus wrote that, quote, "The best timber which comes into Greece for the carpenter's use is from Macedonia," end of quote. Timber, pitch, and minerals all appear to have been royal monopolies. Much of the land was also owned by the king, although he might grant it to individuals in small or large estates and permit them to take revenue from it. All this meant that in stable times, a strong king controlled substantial and highly profitable resources, which provided a generous income. Insecurity and instability eroded this, weakening each king and making it harder for them to assert control. Under Alexander I, Upper and Lower Macedonia were united. By the end of the 5th century BCE, the regional kingdoms of Upper Macedonia were loose allies for the king of Macedon, sometimes willing to accept his rule, but at other times joining his enemies to fight for their independence. Since 399 BCE, prolonged weakness had loosened the bonds even further. The kings were simply not strong enough to be worth courting for the regional monarchs, nor powerful enough to assert control. Over time, the regions became more and more independent. Some looked elsewhere for friends better able to provide protection against the Illyrians and others. The Orestes joined the Mosolian tribes, describing themselves as Ostrae Mosli rather than Ostrae Macedons. They were also old links of culture and alliance to neighbors like the Molossians, many as strong or stronger than the bonds of Macedonia. Similarly, Greek cities on the coast had at times acknowledged the king asserted their own independence, often marking this by minting coins in their name. So we are in the position of seeing what was there in Macedonia and how they simply needed to get some kind of unification. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.